Remember, if you bought a house anywhere but Santa Barbara, you didn't pay enough unless you bought the Manor, Aaron and Candy Spelling's house, for $165 million. And we have a potential buyer who heard me discuss it, and he's interested in writing an offer. Historian Neil Graffy, welcome back to Radio Real Estate, Neil Graffy.
Thank you, Mark. This can't be this hard to get the money for that. It just takes seven numbers on the right lottery ticket. So how hard can that be? Seven numbers.
You know, I don't know if you could win enough on the lotto to buy a $165 million home just to pay the taxes after you bought it and the staff. It's just beyond comprehension. However, Santa Barbara historian Neil Graffy did a presentation on behalf of the Maritime Museum to commemorate the 80th anniversary of the February 23rd, 1942 attack, 2 months after Pearl Harbor, in which a Japanese submarine surfaced and shelled the Elwood oil field near Goleta. How did that presentation go?
It went very well. They reported that they had some 300 people signed up for the Zoom presentation, and we had a live audience of 9 people. Obviously, due to the COVID effect, we had a small audience, so it was a lot of fun. Great presentation, good audience, great questions from everybody out in Zoom land, and of course, the Maritime Museum is just a phenomenal place. They've got a great exhibit on the Elwood attack, as well as Santa Barbara's maritime history, and Santa Barbara's history is the ocean, so it's a wonderful place to go.
I didn't know they had an exhibit.
They not only do they have the exhibit, but they also have a door that was on an oil derrick that got littered with shell fragments from the attack, and so that door had been at the Goleta Historical Museum, and they sent it over to the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum. So they have it on display at the Maritime Museum.
Oh, that's too much. That's too much. I also mentioned David Karpeles, and you also are aware of him and his family moving out. His mom moved him out.
The story goes that his mother saw the submarine and decided the Pacific Coast was not a good place to be, so they headed back to, I guess Duluth was where they went. That's about as far away from the coast as you can possibly get. And so that's all I know about that story. That was mentioned in his obituary. And on the subject of museums, of course, David Karpeles founded a number of museums. He had a foundation to take care of all these museums. He had one in Santa Barbara. He had an exceptionally large archive of material and a wide base of things. For example, he has a lot of stuff, to get off the topic of Elwood, he had a lot of stuff from the original Star Trek TV series, phasers, designs, uniforms, blueprints, scripts. And they did a great seminar on that. So his museums, they're all over the United States. I don't know how many he had, but they've always put on wonderful talks with great panels of historians and experts on whatever subject they were bringing up. And he has copies of constitutions from different countries. I don't know if he had the American Constitution, but just an incredible collection of material.
What I always remembered, and the only thing I knew about his museums, was I heard they were called manuscript museums, which you mentioned, but something like Star Trek, that's wild.
It was wild, and what was really fun is there was a gentleman in Santa Barbara, Kellum DeForest, who worked with Gene Roddenberry on the original Star Trek TV show, and Kellum was one of those persons who authenticated everything, made sure that if there was a movie or TV show being shot, that they had the right guns for the periods, the right costumes, the right everything. He was a fact checker. And he was so good that Roddenberry was joking one time that they were starting off a TV, talking about the next TV script, and they said, well, they're going to be on Rigel 4, and Kellum Forrest said, impossible. They couldn't get to Rigel 4 in this amount of time because we were just on, you know, some other planet. So even though it was completely a falsified, you know, a fantasy TV show, Kellum had it all figured out. He was the guy that came up with the star date that they used on Star Trek. He chose the name Captain James Tiberius Kirk. And so Kellum sadly has passed on. He was a wonderful Santa Barbara historian and reference person. And the Santa Barbara Historical Museum is going to be doing a talk or an exhibit on Kellum's grandfather's art, the Lockwood DeForest. And I'm also doing this talk on Elwood for the Santa Barbara Historical Museum this Wednesday, which is the 80th anniversary to the date of the attack at Elwood. So you can check the Santa Barbara Historical Museum website and register for the Zoom talk.
Well, and plus live audience?
No, this will be Zoom. There will be no live audience. I'll be sitting in the comfort of my home in front of my computer and logging all the images out. And
what have you selected for your background?
Nothing, because I'm just a little tiny picture up in the right-hand corner, so there's not much of a background that you can see if I put it up there.
I was thinking, since we now, you know, the mask mandate has been lifted, maybe if you had done the Maritime Museum thereafter, I wonder if you would have had a bigger crowd.
If we had known, I'm sure that Dacia at the Historical Museum would have set it up for a courtyard talk, and we would have had a live audience. Now, all of these talks have been recorded. So I did a talk for Montecito Bank for their M Club, and they have that up on YouTube. The talk I did for the Maritime Museum, the people from TV Santa Barbara came out, and they shot it. So it'll be, and they're cutting back and forth to a full image of me and my slides and back to me. So it's a little more presenter-oriented, where you can see what I look like instead of a little tiny picture up in the corner.
How would that be found? Also on YouTube?
It'll be off of the Maritime Museum's website when they have it ready, and I don't know how long it'll take for the TV Santa Barbara to edit and put all the cuts back and forth that they're going to use.
Well, if you don't get your full of Neil Graffy during this interview, you could get more of Neil. Go to the Maritime Museum, Santa Barbara Maritime Museum's website, or search YouTube and put in Neil Graffy, and you'll find him. Great TV stuff. Next time you come on, let's just talk about TV. I love historical TV. Now, am I mistaken? Isn't DeForest, wasn't that the name of the actor who played the doctor? DeForest Kelly.
Yeah, DeForest Kelly. But so it could be DeForest, Kelly, so which... But no, no relationship.
And Lockwood DeForest, why do I know that name?
Lockwood DeForest was a painter, a well-known, highly regarded painter. And I believe that it's his son was the landscape architect, Lockwood DeForest Jr. And there's just a lot of art and inspiration coming from the entire DeForest family, all the way from Lockwood DeForest 1, 2, and Kellum.
And they were Santa Barbarians?
They had moved to Santa Barbara. Lockwood DeForest Sr. had moved to Santa Barbara, yeah.
Well, it's the son, Lockwood DeForest, the landscape guy that I guess I know the name.
Yeah, so when we've talked about a lot of the different estates in Santa Barbara at various times, it's highly noted that Lockwood DeForest was the landscape architect for it.
Right. My guest historian, Neil Graffy, who came on to talk about the... anniversary of the bombing of the Elwood oil field near Goleta, and we have yet to touch on that topic. We're out of time. Neil, thanks for joining me. I was just kidding.
So... I was ready to go make breakfast, okay.
Yeah, I just read, don't have heavy cereal for breakfast. Some proteins, you keep it light, fruit and protein. Actually, I knew that for years. So tell me, it was pretty crazy. 2 months after Pearl Harbor, I've read a little bit about it before you coming on, and there were some questions about, you know, were they really intending to do damage? Were they trying to scare us? And then there was some story about the captain of that Japanese ship who had been embarrassed because the Japanese used to use the oil fields with permission a while back. So jump on in.
All righty. Well, we do have that the submarine in question was called the I-17, and it was one of 20 Japanese submarines that were part of the naval force that came out to Pearl Harbor. So it did not participate at Pearl Harbor, but was at the ready along with 20 other submarines. 2 weeks after Pearl Harbor, 8 of the submarines were sent to the west coast of the United States, and their mission there was to attack shipping. And what they were hoping to do was to draw the what was left of the U.S. Navy Pacific Fleet to the west coast and get them out of the Pacific Ocean and along the coast where they might be more easily attacked by the submarines. The submarines had also been ordered to shell U.S. cities on Christmas Eve with 30 shells off of each submarine. And that didn't happen, but the I-17, our submarine in question, did fire at 3 merchant ships in late December, sunk one of them, and then returned back to its base in the Marshall Islands to get refueled, refinished, and then came back out to the West Coast. And this time their orders were to, again, attack shipping. But also they decided that firing on coastal cities was a bad idea because of civilian loss, and it they just thought they shouldn't do that. But instead they were to find some spots to shell and to do some damage, like to roadways and highways, once again to bring the U.S. Navy's ships off the West Coast and get them out of the Pacific Ocean. And so the I-17 arrived in San Diego on February 20th, was heading up the coast, surfaced off Elwood, and started firing. About 25 to 29 shells is the count that they fired at the large refinery sections there at Elwood.
And they were unsuccessful in delivering any significant damage?
That is correct. There was a large refinery, and they missed the refinery. They shot over it. And then there was also a very large, it's either 80,000 gallons of gasoline, 800,000 gallons, but it was a large, giant storage tank of high-test gasoline. And they were firing at that. And, of course, you know, they're on a submarine. They're a mile offshore. They're bouncing in the waves. It's not exactly a perfectly smooth day. And so as they're firing at the large oil tank, instead they hit a pier, one of the oil piers. There was about, I forget how many, maybe 15 or so, 20 oil piers off of Elwood. And so they hit one of the piers and did some damage to planking. Then they hit another pier and they damaged an oil pump. They did $500 worth of damage. Plenty of witnesses that watched this thing happen. So just think of this. It's just after sunset, so the sky is lit, and you're sitting there minding your own business working in these oil fields, or for the Wheeler family that had the inn just where the Sandpiper Golf Course is now, which was where the oil fields were. Their inn looked out over the ocean, and they hear these noises. You look out, and you see a submarine. And can you imagine how bizarre that would be? You realize that Pearl Harbor is attacked. That's 2,500 miles away. Europe, there's a war going on. That's thousands of miles away. To think that peaceful Santa Barbara, you're sitting there and a submarine surfaces and starts firing shells. I mean, just think today if you were playing at the Sandpiper Golf Club and you're about to tee off and a North Korean submarine comes up and starts firing shells and, you know, ruining your stroke.
I got to tell you.
It would be a panic situation. You'd be completely freaked out about this. It doesn't happen here. You know, they sink merchant ships, but they don't fire shells right where we're having our lunch or our dinner.
And, of course, it forced David Karpeles, am I pronouncing his name correctly?
Karpeles.
David Karpeles' mother literally left town. She took it to heart. And, God, you've said so much. My guest historian, Neil Graffy, talking about the 80th anniversary of the shelling of the Elwood oil fields. And it's a good thing they really didn't hit enough to cause an oil spill, because they would have lost the war a lot sooner because the environmentalists would have gotten involved and they would have killed the Japanese.
Yeah, Coastal Commission would have been furious.
But, yeah, it's good we're laughing about this horrific event. Thankfully, no minimal damage, no lives were lost. But the psychologically, as you mentioned, it's now they're 2,500 miles from Hawaii. You mentioned they were here and they went back to refuel at the Marshall Islands. Where the heck are they?
That's another 2,500 miles west of Hawaii. So you think about that, a 5,000-mile journey to refuel and to get it outfitted, and then you come back again. And during my presentation, I put up a, you know, using Google Earth, I've got a picture of West Coast, Hawaii, Marshall Islands, and just this vast amount of ocean. And when I look at this, you know, when you see something in print, submarine, aircraft carrier, battleship, you think of all these sailors, no matter which country they're in, crossing these vast amount of oceans. And when I looked at that picture, I just realized, oh, my God, what these guys went through. It really brought it home to me. You know, it's one thing, like I say, to read it in print, and then when you visualize the expanse and the size of the distance that they traveled. And so I'm still trying to find out, do submarines always travel underwater, or do they travel on the surface? Underwater, they use battery power. On the surface, they use diesel power. The diesel engines also recharge the battery. So they have to surface. If they're underwater, they can only go for so long before they have to surface to recharge the batteries. So those are just little byproducts I'm finding out about to round out the story of what was life like on a Japanese submarine. How did they get from point A to point B? How did they radio back without being caught? So there's lots of interesting stories and information still being accumulated on this.
My guest, historian Neil Graffy, do you know off the top how many miles the Marshall Islands is to Japan?
I do not, but I bet during the commercial break we could probably kick that one in immediately and find
right.
out.
Because here they are coming 5,000 miles, and I went online and I Googled something and saw some little video, and they talked about the number of men on the ship and how long it could go, how many days. Apparently, I mean, I don't know how long it took to go from the Marshall Island, 5,000 miles? Jeez.
It took them about, I think, about 2 weeks to get from the Marshall Islands back off to San Diego again.
And yeah, what do? You call 911 in 1942 and you say, hey, there's a submarine here. Can you send the Marines? Or how did people react?
Well, curiously enough, there's a lot of, at first, what seemed like urban legends that there was a coastal artillery unit that was based in Goleta, and a day or two before the attack, they were sent to Los Angeles, and I was able to verify that that actually did happen. And when the attack happened, the, you know, various people were calling in, and people were not believing them, saying, no, it's just, it's our guys doing some artillery practice. And finally, someone said, no, they are doing this. So notes were sent down to command headquarters, which were down in Los Angeles, and the artillery unit that had been in Santa Barbara, sent to L.A., as now was heading back to Santa Barbara. They got here about 9 p.m. Two airplanes were sent out from Bakersfield, but they didn't get here till 10 o'clock. They dropped flares over the ocean, but the submarine was long gone. The submarine surfaced at 7 o'clock, just as President Roosevelt was beginning one of his fireside chats. This was Roosevelt's second talk to the American people since Pearl Harbor. So everybody was gathered around their sets. And the submarine, 10 minutes into his talk, is when it started firing. So everybody pretty much agrees at 7:10 p.m. Pacific time, the submarine started firing. It shelled, the count is from between 25 to 29 shells. And it did that for about 45 minutes and then turned around and left. And that's the story.
We would guess that they intentionally, you know, did it at that time, maybe?
Well, that was one of the great theories, was that at the time, the newspapers reported they must have been listening to President Roosevelt's chat, and they did this on purpose to disrupt his chat called, or his fireside chat called, The Progress of the War, was the title of his talk. And so it was believed that they were listening to the broadcast, but as far as I know, nobody on the ship was speaking English.
We are going to take a break. My guest, Neil Graffy, talking about the 80th anniversary of the Japanese shelling of the Elwood oil field near Goleta, 2 months after Pearl Harbor. And we'll check and see the distance from the Marshall Islands to Japan, because we know Marshall Islands 2,500 miles west of Hawaii, and we're about 2,500 miles from Hawaii. And I want to ask I didn't know they were at Pearl Harbor. I didn't know that there was this plan for them to hit the Pacific coast, and I want to find out why it didn't work. And there's a rumor I want to ask Neil about. Mark Schneidman's Radio Real Estate, radiorealestate.com. Stay tuned. You'll be right back.